Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is the Canadian diplomat and public servant, Alan Gottlieb. His career in the Canadian Foreign Service extended for 30 years, culminating in his service as Ambassador of Canada to the United States from 1981 to 1988. That service in Washington is chronicled in his book, The Washington Diaries. Ambassador Gottlieb, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thank you very much.
The strategic environment has really changed since the time when you were ambassador. That is the global environment. What do you see as the most important changes?
Well, possibly from the standpoint of Canada-U.S. relations, possibly you could say it was the end of the Cold War. The Cold War, during World War II, Canada and the United States formed a defense alliance, a relationship. William Lyon Mackenzie King, the Canadian Prime Minister, Franklin Roosevelt, and we developed a joint approach to the defense of North America. After the war, you had the Cold War, and many perhaps are too young now to remember, but the Cold War was quite unique because I think it was an existential threat to the United States. The Soviet Union had the capacity to destroy the United States. No other country has had that. And that meant that our defense relationship deepened a great deal. And the physical proximity of Canada and the United States, the geography, the landmass up north, all this was vital to United States security. And so we formed a defense sharing arrangements. We formed NORAD, a defense arrangement. We were close allies in NATO. And the result was, I think, that Canada had virtually a unique relationship with the United States. We've always shared common values, common history, common border, but the Cold War brought us into a unique relationship, and the United States' vulnerability was felt to be reduced by its alliance, military alliance with Canada. When the Cold War ended, there was no enemy anymore. And a curious thing happened, and it's called 9/11. And 9/11 reintroduce the notion of vulnerability to the United States, I believe. In this case, though, for whatever the reason, Canada was seen not as a point of strength in terms of United States security, but a point of weakness. And the result was the border began to thicken and become an obstacle to our commerce, the movement of peoples and goods. There was a myth went abroad in your country that the bombers or the pilots that flew those planes into the World Trade Center came from Canada. Of course, it did not. But the result was that the enemy, now being a terrorist, there's been almost, and maybe this is an exaggeration, but a reversal of the perception of Canada in that our border is seen as a point of U.S. vulnerability. And so I think the relationship has changed. And I don't think it's changed necessarily for the better because of that.
And so that the economic dependence of Canada on the United States, which in a way depends on that open border, becomes an apparent vulnerability to those people who manage homeland security and national security in the United States.
I think that's what's happened because of the during this period of our Cold War. we went very far towards economic integration, the two countries.
And I think you say in an article that three-fourths of Canada's income is related to trade?
Roughly, to exports and into exports into your country. And so we went along quite far under the old GATT rules, and during this period of our history, to a very closely integrated relationship with the United States. And the key point there, although the exports are very important, they can't be seen in a traditional way as an export, let's say, from Korea or Japan. They were products of joint manufacturing. The border became irrelevant. We developed something called the Auto Pact, which brought about the production of all North American automobiles by General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, on both sides of the border. So many of our industrial products would cross the border 5, 6, 7 times back and forth to produce the finished goods. So when you resurrect, the border was really more and more irrelevant. Now, when you reimpose the border, when you reinvent the border, it goes right through the heart of a joint industrial production, just-in-time production. And this is very disruptive.
When you were ambassador, that period must have been the high point of a mutual respect and a mutual interdependency. And in doing many of the things that you accomplished, it was during your ambassadorship that the problem of acid rain was dealt with. It was during your time as ambassador that a free trade agreement was negotiated, which ultimately led to NAFTA. As your book chronicles, you are an astute observer of the American political scene. What do you see in the way the American system works that has turned this security concern about the border into some might say, hysteria?
Well, I had my years in Washington virtually corresponded to a very distinguished American called Ronald Reagan. And the curious thing is that many people don't really appreciate it or understand it, but Ronald Reagan had a special thing about Canada. He regarded Canada and the United States as different, and that relationship as special. And he was the first American leader to articulate the concept of North American trilateralism, which included Mexico. But he had a wonderful sense of the importance of Canada and the United States. And I was astonished, one of my early calls in the White House, to be told that Ronald Reagan has a hard time saying no to Canada, that he has a very special regard for Canada. So the result, and it was basically a deeply felt view about the importance of our two countries and their relationship, historic and current. So, as you say, we negotiated a free trade agreement. We negotiated an absolutely pathfinding agreement on the environment, the acid rain accord. And that deep, deep sense of the importance of Canada, we call it maybe a romantic view, but deep, deep sense, I think is gone. And I don't sense in Washington today, I don't sense any particular view or appreciation of the strategic importance of the relationship. I don't sense it. I don't know that it. Maybe it's there, but I have no. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that it's there. Why would you reconstruct the border if you want to bring our two countries, keep them as close together as possible? And then since that time, we've had a tremendous amount of noise and criticism coming out of official circles, particularly in the Congress, about Canadian energy, that it's not clean enough. We've seen the redevelopment, we've seen the explosion's too strong word, but the amazing growth of Buy America provisions, very, very disruptive to our economy, very much reinventing the existence of the border. As Janet Napolitano, who is the Secretary of the Interior, said a few months ago, we need to make this a real border. It's got to be a real border. Well, I think the opposite. It should be a non-border. And that was the philosophy and attitude of Franklin Roosevelt and of Ronald Reagan and most American presidents and administrations. We did all we could to make it as least disruptive for a factor as possible. So there, I don't sense that there is a strategic view of the importance of Canada. And I find that very, very bizarre, to tell you the truth. Because take your example, energy. United States, and these figures are not totally accurate, but I think they're generally correct. United States imports, what, about 20 million barrels, consumes about 20 million barrels of oil a day. It imports about half that, 10 million barrels a day, 9 million barrels a day. The Canadian oil sands, which are being developed in a jurisdiction that is as friendly to the United States as any jurisdiction in the world outside of the United States itself, they can produce, and they're a road to producing, if the investment is there, 5 million barrels a day. Right now, there's only one customer, the United States. That would reduce, within a decade, the United States could reduce its dependence on Middle Eastern oil by half. It would be a geopolitical revolution for the United States. Now, that's a strategic fact. But I don't sense there's any appreciation of this enormous significance of Canadian resources, Canadian energy, Canadian uranium to the security of the United States. They're somewhere, I suppose, but it's not obvious to me where it is.
Now in the case of the sand oil, that is requires a high degree of energy to produce the oil. So does it run up against environmental concerns? Because what I'm hearing you saying is there is on the one hand a concern about terrorism, which may or may not be coming from your border, and on the other hand, an inability to recognize the importance of the relationship because it's obscured by other concerns. So environmentalism would lead to a concern about the oil.
The environmental, yeah, a lot of the environmental lobbies are very critical of the oil sands. Canada is the number one exporter of oil to the United States today. It's the number one exporter of gas. It's the number one exporter of uranium. It's the number one exporter of electricity. It's the number one exporter of oil. No other country comes even close. The oil that's being imported into the United States today is, for the larger measure of it, is oil sands. It is oil sands. And oil sands have been in production for 10, 15 years, 20 years. In fact, they were originally whole process was invented by American engineers and American companies, in particular Sunoil. And so, yes, it's called dirty oil by the lobbyists and by the environmental group. Yes, it does consume energy. And yes, it does have a very major impact on the landscape, and it's very easy. It looks like a sort of a moonscape. But in fact, it is not really significantly dirty. It's not dirtier than any other form of unconventional energy, which is the future. And in fact, a technology is leading it to becoming much more clean. And so it is a vital, it's not without problems, but it is an absolutely vital resource. Now, that strategic thinking, if it takes place, is going to take place in the White House. I don't expect, I wouldn't, to find it in the Congress. Although I will say in my time, there were some congressmen, senators, who were remarkable about Canada. One of them was Senator Moynihan. Another was Senator Bradley. They did have, from New Jersey and New York, they did have a strategic view of Canada. They without their support, I'm not sure we would have had a free trade agreement. They really went to bat for a free trade agreement, even though there were trade problems in their states or constituencies. I don't see that in the Congress today. I think the Congress, the special interests that are so influential, are there is no room for the strategic factor. And in the White House, if people are thinking about this in the bowels of the State Department, if they're thinking about this, the importance of clean energy and the importance of our strategic relationship, if they're thinking about it in the CIA, if they're thinking about it in the bowels of the NSC, if they're thinking about it in the bowels of the CIA, well, I'd be surprised. I don't think they're thinking about it at all.
Going back to your period as the ambassador and your book, you developed a fine sense of the way the relationship had to be worked in a different way, that you as the ambassador, it wasn't just visits to the State Department, but it was really getting to know the congressman, their concerns, say, working the Congress and with the Congress. You also, in your diaries, really have a sense of the importance of the media at that time. And the media has become almost a different, more treacherous animal from our perspective in our domestic concerns. Does any of your thinking about why we're not recognizing the dimensions of the Canadian-American relation, can it draw on that experience to help us understand? Because it may just not just be that there's no strategic recognition in the executive, but also in these other sources of decentralized power, there are forces working against it. Is that what's up here?
That is what is up. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, traditional diplomacy, which we practice in Canada before my time, is that all official relations are conducted through the intermediary of the State Department, of the Foreign Ministry, and with the executive branch. And it became evident to me after not very long that this was a recipe for failure on our part. And so we began to major effort to take our message to the Congress and to explain to congressmen and senators about the importance of Canada. And I think, as I mentioned, I think we had some success. The free trade agreement would not have been passed without very significant leadership from the Congress. We have to continue to do that. And there's no question that today our embassy practices public diplomacy. And the Congress is a major objective for our diplomacy to demonstrate our mutuality of our interests. Why Buy America is not bad just for Canada, but is equally bad for the United States. Why the dismissal or lack of appreciation of our energy resources is harmful not just to Canada, but the United States. So that is what our diplomacy is largely aimed at today. One of the things that I found out in my time there, which I thought was quite remarkable, that Canada, as your closest neighbor, ally, and a country which is by far the largest purchaser of your exports, that our interests were affected not by United States foreign policy in the grand sense, but by its domestic policy, particularly protectionism, and by the lobbying of special interests, whether it's forest products, or fish, or raspberries, or hogs. And I looked at a list, and almost every one of the disputes that were on the table between Canada and the United States at that time were originated in the Congress. So that meant we had to reorient our whole diplomatic strategy. And I think if I deserve any credit on this planet, I think I will take it for being the person who led the way on that. Nevertheless, if you look at it today, it's a very, very tough task. The Congress is facing so many severe issues, as we all know. I mean, the test of health care and the environment, the job creation. So it's hard to get that message across. And beyond that, Canada is a foreign power. We can't contribute to the campaigns of any congressmen or senators. we can't interfere in the we can't interfere in the affairs of the United States. We have to be very circumspect. And between the conflict of two special interests, let's say the contract between conflict between a special interest, let's say on foreign forest products, for example, and a foreign government, well, guess who's going to win? In most interests, it's going to be the case. It's going to be the special interests because of what they contribute. And you, as you know, as an American, not millions, not tens of millions, hundreds of millions are spent on lobbying. And it's never been higher than today. It's absolutely, it's exploded in its significance. So it's a very tough game to play. And Canada is very dependent on the United States for the, you know, 25-35% of our 70-80% of our exports, 30-35% of our GNP. So we face a great deal of vulnerability, and that's why I believe it's so critically important for the White House to show leadership. I mean, the White House, your president, they're surrounded by an enormous amount of talent. Do they have a strategic view of the Middle East? I think they do. I mean, they may not be successful in their strategies, but they have a strategic view. Do they have a strategic view of the importance of India? I think they do. I think the United States, as shown, do they have a strategic view of the importance of the multilateralism? Yes, they do. Do they have a strategic view of the importance of Canada? I doubt it. I don't see it. I hope I'm wrong.
Is part of the problem here, as I listen to you, that in a way our relationship with Canada is regional, and therefore we have to, it's as a regional power, and from that perspective that Canada is really important, whereas our mission for the world has been a global vision. That global vision, that strategic global vision, is unraveling for many of the reasons that you just made in the relationship, the comments you just made about the regional relationship with Canada. What I guess I'm wondering as I listen to you is that really the structure of international power and our role as the dominant and leading power, which is still a reality, but we are increasingly unable to act on it.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. Our relationship is regional, whereas, as I mentioned earlier, during the 50 years of the Cold War, it wasn't regional because the threat was different. And so when the Cold War ended, our global strategic importance to the United States diminished or disappeared, particularly in the decade or so when you were, quote-unquote, the sole superpower. And then today, is there an enemy? It's not the Soviet Union, obviously. It's not Russia. It's not China, really. It's terrorism, the terrorists. And there, it didn't have to. It shouldn't be this way. There's no reason our response to terrorism couldn't be, hey, this is a serious threat, obviously, to the United States, to Canada. Why don't we have a joint security perimeter? We've had 60 years of a joint defense. Why don't we just try to create a perimeter around the area of the two countries so that we have control at the outer limits? If you go to Europe, they have the security now at the perimeter. You can go from Lisbon to Athens without going through a security check, as you know. So why can't we do that? Well, instead of doing that, we've been going the other way. And we have intensified the regional nature of our relationship. So what we need here, I think, is some vision, maybe on the part of both our countries.
And let me be clear about something. The breakdown occurred after 9/11 under both Republicans, the Bush administration, and now in the Obama administration.
I think 9/11 was the most significant factor in the history of our two countries in the last 50 years or more. And I don't know where it's going to lead at the end or how far. But on your point, when it first occurred, there was a major effort on the part of the administration and Canada to keep things. You remember during 9/11, they back up for weeks at the border. It was chaos. And we had some strong leadership in both the Bush administration and in the Canadian administration under the Conservatives and the Liberals, the Liberals and the Conservatives. And we developed a concept called smart borders. And we did go some distance to kind of keep the system oiled. I don't know quite if you asked me to describe what happened after that, but I think what happened is something called Homeland Security, which turns developed into a very, from a non-existent agency, into perhaps the most powerful agency in Washington today, or so it seems to many. It's a leviathan, and with a powerful bureaucracy, huge reach, and with a mission: protect the borders of the United States. Well, I say that's the wrong mission. The mission should be protect the borders of North America, and through that, the United States. But they are nationally oriented, and they're oriented to the 49th parallel in terms of Canada and the United States. And that leviathan grows bigger every day. Now, we introduced something 2 years ago, a new rule, the United States did, came out of the Congress and Homeland Security, that Americans couldn't travel to Canada, couldn't come back from Canada without a passport, and Canadians couldn't enter without a passport. That had an enormous impact. We had gone through hundreds of years and no passport. That was the experience of Canadians and Americans. My father was born in Saskatchewan in the 19th century. He crossed the border, and his father and his grandfather, they probably pushed a cart across the border, but they crossed the border to make a living all the time. My father was inducted into the U.S. Army because he was living in St. Paul at the time. Then he came back to Winnipeg in 1920 and spent the next 50 years there. So that border barely, it wasn't on our consciousness. And as a result, the economy developed on both sides. The integration began. And now, with this highly powerful agency devoted to making the United States safe, and in the knowledge, and surely it's understandable in a sense, that any terrorist activity in the United States today that occurred would be terrifying. So they have that one mandate. But the problem is the vision, to me. In order to make the United States safe from terrorism, the way to go was not to reinvent or reconstruct a wall across our continent.
In the early phase, the border issues and the whole focus on a smart border came under the leadership of Tom Ridge, who was really sensitive to all of the economic traffic that was going across the border. And what one has the sense that when he left, there was a transition to people with concern for national security, who national security then involves erecting a wall and so on. So it was a movement of away from forces that are committed to globalization, open borders, economic efficiency, to people focused on matters of policing and keeping out the terrorists.
I think that's right. I think that's what happened. Although, if you go back earlier on to 9/11 and then the smart border concept, there was an initiative on the part of President Bush, and it was called the Security and Prosperity Partnership. And they had their first meeting of the three leaders, the President of Mexico, United States, the Prime Minister of Canada, in Waco, Texas. And this was called the SPP Initiative. And conceptually, it was correct. They said, well, we have to have security, but we can't let it undermine our partnership, our economic partnership. So conceptually, it was right. But in fact, nothing happened. They met, they talked, they left, they set up committees, the committees met, nothing happened. It lacked Well, it's a very challenging question as to what went wrong. But I think it lacked vision, it lacked top-down leadership, and through the interstices of these processes, there was the creeping control at the border, the creeping security control, the extension to more and more areas, more obstacles, more regulations, more technicalities.
In your work as a diplomat in relating to your own country and to the United States, I think you must have, and you do have, a sense of leadership. And you're saying now we need a strategic vision in the relationship. What are the elements do you see if we focus on leadership in our country, presidential leadership, what are the requirements to make that happen? Because you would be building something new, and what kind of a leader can do that?
Well, it's a good question, and I wish I could give an answer which reflected any degree of optimism on my part. Let's look at it from the standpoint of the two capitals, Washington and Ottawa. If Canada were to propose, which I think it should now, that the two countries enter into an agreement to have a single economic space and a single security space, I don't think there's any interest in Washington. I don't see it. Possibly I'm wrong, but I don't see it. If you look at Ottawa, well, there are many Canadians that think we've gone too far in our relationship with the United States. We're too dependent. We need to diversify. We need new markets. That we can't rely on the United States. We had this free trade agreement and it was good, but we now have a creeping new tariffs coming in through these border obstacles. We had demonstrations of the fallibility of our dispute settlement mechanism in dealing with these enormously complex and decade-long dispute over forest products. That the United States may be our best friend, but nevertheless, our access to their market is facing increasing obstacles, and that we should reduce our dependence on the United States. And if we enter into an agreement to pursue a single economic space like in Europe, we'll become more dependent. At least that's a view. I don't share it, but it is a view. So the politics in Ottawa are not so great. Nevertheless, and in Washington, they're not great either. So the prospects of in the case of Canada, we haven't had a majority government now for several years. We have a minority government. We will have an election again in the next year or so. We may have another minority government. Minority governments don't have a national mandate. They manage to exist through the skill of their parliamentary techniques. So is there a likelihood that a political leader with the kind of vision that I'm talking about and advocating will appear on the horizon in the next few years? I have to say I'm pessimistic about it. But I do believe without it, it won't happen. We wouldn't have a free trade agreement today if it hadn't been for one Canadian political leader, that was Brian Mulroney. He did have the vision. And he did a reversal, because when he was elected, he was against the free trade agreement. But without his vision, and without a similar vision by Ronald Reagan, you would not have had the agreement. So we did have at that time two visionary leaders. So it may happen again.
Are you raising questions implicitly about what's happening in the world with the events of 9/11 and also the economic collapse that we've had in 2008, a question about whether there can be a unifying structure obviously, our conversation is focusing on Canada and the U.S., but the questions you're raising really relate to especially America's global role, and also you're suggesting that Canada may not be able to play the role that it played in this earlier period as a middle power complementing American power.
Well, I'm not so sure I agree with that. As I see the world as it's developing, it is moving into a 19th century configuration. In spite of all the talk about United Nations and international organizations and global organizations and global voluntary organizations, the map looks more and more to me like a 19th century map. And we're talking about the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. What are the BRICS? These are sovereign states. And they're exercising muscle. And they're economically growing. And they're competitive. And they're pursuing their own national interests. And so I think we will have this, to use the most terribly overused word in this area, the multipolar world. We're going to have a number of sovereign states. What are they pursuing? Pursuing their national interest. I think that from the United States' point of view, it's going to have to adjust from being the world's only superpower to being an enormously important power, maybe the strongest in the world, but with many, many players. The rise of China and India, these are the hallmark of this century. So from the United States' point of view, I would say their geopolitical relationship with Canada is immensely important. Because the two of us together, have many more resources, far greater reach in many directions, and could be in a close alliance, could be very helpful to each other in navigating through this world of competing sovereign states. From Canada, I think we can continue to play a similar role, but I think the pressure is going to be on Canada, and I could understand it, to diversify more and to reduce that dependence for the United States and to open up. Right now, we can't sell a lot of our products abroad, like our energy, because we don't have the infrastructure. So I think the time is going to come, may well, that if the United States is saying, well, frankly, dear, we don't want your energy, then I think Canada is going to rethink its role in the world. And I think Canada, which is a successful state, it's a state which has overcome serious issues of national unity. It's a state which is admired today for the sobriety of its economic policies. I think Canada has a very promising future, as not as a superpower, but as a major power and a major player in the world, orchestrating and calibrating its relationship with a number of major sovereign states. First and foremost will be the United States. But nevertheless, it will be one much more diversified maybe than today.
In a lecture that you gave in 2005, you painted a picture of a conflict within foreign policy circles in Canada, really a division between idealism and realism, counting yourself, I think, as a realist and arguing that what had happened in a recent period in Canada is a diminishing of the commitment of resources to Canada's foreign policy and a focus on spreading Canadian values abroad, of seeing your role as one in which you could transform the world. It almost sounded like a soft humanitarian intervention. As you talk a little about that, because is that still a concern if you're going to have a realistic policy that focuses on bread and butter issues, which suggests that you might diversify, as you were just suggesting?
Well, I think we've seen in Canada something which is not exactly a mirror image, but it reflects what's also happened and has happened over the last 100 years in your own country, where you've had high points of Wilsonian idealism and you've had times of far more limited ambitions on the international score. In fact, I think, and if you look at the Iraq exercise and the spread of democracy and the Iraq experience, and you may well be going through a reversal of that period now, where a more, let's say, a more carefully assessed view of the strength of your power and reach is taking place. In the case of Canada, we have shifted between these two poles. We have a tradition of the realpolitik, but we've had a strong tradition of humanitarian intervention, of human security. In other words, the export of our values and of our sometimes we have rather been self-congratulatory, unfortunately, about our country. Sometimes we have acted as if we were, quote-unquote, a moral superpower. Well, we're not. But I think I see in Canada now, in the last half dozen years, a steady movement towards a more realistic approach to our place in the world. And I think that's very healthy, and I think it'll make us more influential rather than less. Because if you're a smaller country and you don't have great resources, and you go around talking about the spread of democracy, and you go around talking about protecting the victims throughout Africa and the world, well, if you don't deliver, then your words sound hypocritical. And I think the problem with a lot of this noble language is that we couldn't deliver. At the same time we were talking that way, we were reducing our aid program, we were reducing our diplomatic resources, we were starving our army, and we were talking about saving the world. Well, let me say, hopefully, one hopes that when that period is in the past for Canada. I think there is, maybe I'm being a little too optimistic here, but I think there is a national consensus forming around the notion that we have to be more realistic in our foreign policy goals, and they have to be more directed to our national interest in a very competitive and multi-sovereignty world of the kind that we were talking about.
If you were looking ahead to the kind of agenda that you would like to see between the U.S. and Canada, because you're suggesting there may be a turning point down the road where you're going to have to go and look outside of this region to find partners and so on. What do you see as concrete cases where things have to be done to secure the new version of this old relationship which you are attracted to?
Well, I think the single most important thing that needs to be done is a commitment to reduce the friction on our border. And that means both security friction and economic friction. We have the two of the most integrated economies in the world. But we have mountains of regulations on each side of the border, which make both of our economies less. We're the world's two biggest trading partners. We make our economies less competitive. We inhibit our growth. We reduce the number of jobs available through the vast inefficiency of our trading relationship. We need to eliminate this duplication of regulations. We need to eliminate all these trade actions against each other. We need to adopt a common security policy. And I think that it won't happen tomorrow, but I believe within 10 years, it may well happen. And then I think the reason why it's important for both of us is because it'll make both of us stronger countries and make us more economically competitive and more able to provide to our citizens the standard of living and security which the extremely problematic state of the world we're moving into. So that's my hope. Without that, then I think if that doesn't happen, I think for Canada, our foreign policy will inevitably seek, whether successfully or not, but will seek to de-emphasize the overpowering and overwhelming role of the United States in our country. And it will cause us, I think, to direct a great deal more of our effort towards building relationships, particularly in Asia and in Europe.
Now, what would the world look like if we, the U.S. and Canada, could find ways to complement each other, you know, to act jointly in the world? Do you see that happen? And in what sort of forums would our efforts complement each other in the way that they did during the Cold War?
Well, I think that is going to be done through informal and through diplomacy and consultations. We are two nations that are extraordinarily close in terms of values. And I think that we see the world in a similar way. And this degree of confidence that existed has made us such close allies for so long a time. What we need to do is reduce the number of points of conflict. And we have to make sure that the direction is towards more harmony, less conflict, and more integration than the opposite. The net effect of it, I think, will be that we'll be, through our close relationship, we will, both of us, benefit. From the standpoint of the United States, the potential benefit is Canada is a smaller country with a different history, a different perspective, and a different position in the world. So we can bring that perspective, and we have bought that perspective. So I think that the potential is there. One thing, though, I should say, and which you could ask me, is where does Mexico fit into all this? And here, I must say that my views are perhaps rather old-fashioned, that I think that Canada and the United States, as they did in the Free Trade Agreement, need to lead the way. I think it needs to be done, this kind of breaking down of the obstacles in the way of a closer, more smoother economic relationship and security relationship need to be done between our two countries. And that could be a template for the United States to adopt the same with other countries if it so wishes, as happened with NAFTA. There would be no NAFTA without the NAFTA Free Trade Agreement. So I think Mexico, yes, but a different speed probably. And I would therefore say that what I would like to see is Canada and the United States reinvent the special relationship.
Let's take an area like Afghanistan, where America is clearly performing a global role, maybe a wrong definition of its role, some would argue, in the United States. Canada has been supportive, but it's also a power that increasingly suffers casualty. It becomes harder in the context of your defense budget to maintain that. And I'm wondering, what is the conflict here in the new defense relationship, where the adversary is no longer the Soviet Union? It is a kind of a mission of global order. Can we be partners and continue to be partners?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Afghanistan is the best example of how we can and are partners. I mean, here's a case where Canada just didn't preach and go out and speaking about, you know, the importance of democracy. We actually committed lives, and we are among the first, and we've had among the highest casualties of all countries. And so we, at some point in the future, may rotate out, but we have made a major, major effort. And we've been very, very close with the United States in doing this. And I think this is a perfect example of the collaboration between our countries. And I think it speaks well, I think, for the future of our foreign policy relationship. As a result of Afghanistan as well, or at least as part of it, we have recommitted in Canada much more significantly to military expense. We've increased our capacity. We'd like to think of ourselves as peacekeepers, namely we prevent people from killing each other. But in Afghanistan, we have seen that we have to be more than peacekeepers. We have to be peacemakers, and we have to have the physical wherewithal to to make a military contribution to peace. And so I think Afghanistan has been a very important event in the history of our country. It's one of the reasons I say I think that realism is becoming winning the battle in Canada. Between that and a kind of diffuse and over-articulated sense of saving the world. And I think it is introduced as being largely significant factor in the reinvigoration of our defense relationship between the two countries.
Can you help us understand why Canada has done so well with regard to the recent financial crisis, that you seem to have continue to regulate your banks, and Canada is not a place where you confronted a financial collapse in the way we did. The reason I ask this question is clearly Canada does things differently domestically, and one here in the United States wonders sometimes why we can't emulate you.
Well, it's a very good question about the banks, but I think the answer lies in the fact that in Canada, unlike the United States, you had hundreds of banks. We had interstate national banking from a long time, century. And so we had very large banks. We had really half dozen banks. And you could say, well, they had a national monopoly or oligopoly. As a result of these being large banks, we accepted the need for regulation. We didn't say just go out and compete, because they had such a large market share and they were so important in the life of the country. And thus we grew up with a culture of regulation. And there, that is a part of a larger culture of regulation. It's easy to oversimplify these things and for me and to speak in cliches, but the fact is, as a country, from the beginning, we have probably accepted the need for a larger role for the public sector. We have it in our national health, and we have it in our higher tax rates, at least until the last year or two, and in the extent of our regulation in fields like banking and insurance and financial services. So it was a different cultural tradition. And the result is the banks simply couldn't do some of the things. They had less leverage under regulation. They couldn't, whatever they wanted to do, they couldn't extend themselves to the extent they did in the United States. We were very fortunate. And although they've made mistakes in the past, our banks, and have tended to sometimes follow themselves in going in the wrong direction, in this period, they have been their management has been very sober. And the restraints that exist on their potential role has been a boon for the country. What is significant, though, beyond that, and I must say, I find it very hard to explain this as a Canadian, is how we became so fiscally conservative and cautious in the decade before the Great Recession, 1908. We became the only group of G7 country and one of the few in the OECD that had balanced budgets. And year after year, we produced balanced budgets, greatly reduced our debt. We have to owe that to we have to give the credit, I think, to fairly sober government and to a public attitude that deficits were not a good idea. Had you said to me in the 1980s or 1970s that Canada would be the poster child for fiscal balance and fiscal sobriety in the 90s and in the 21st century, I would have said, forget it. We'll more likely have the IMF all over us. Well, we did it. And so I think that we're showing in Canada, I think, in all parts, including East, West, French, English, we're showing a sense of the importance of the government role, but of constraints on it, of not letting it overtax or run up too much debt. it's a sort of it's a happy event. I can't explain it. I can say that I'm, as a Canadian, I'm very proud of our achievement there.
Well, on that note of a positive example there that maybe America wishes it had followed, I want to thank you very much, Ambassador, for returning to the campus. Yeah, I should mention you got your undergraduate degree here, and it was an honor having you on our program.
Well, it's an honor to be back, and I thank you very much for asking me so many provocative questions.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.